All right. Welcome to the Renegade HPG podcast. My name is Travis, and my guest today is Kurt Weldon. Kurt was a producer for BattleTech, the animated series, which aired a single season back in 1994, and which has seen a modest revival this year after the remastered versions were published on Renegade HPG's YouTube channel. Kurt has been involved in dozens of series before and since BattleTech, and currently works with Nickelodeon Animation as a line producer. Today, we're going to test Kurt's memory a bit and see what kind of stories I can pull out of him about his brief venture into the BattleTech universe. Kurt, thanks for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Travis. And apologize in advance for the dogs.
That's all right. We all love dogs, hopefully.
We may revisit that after,
after the barking. So my first question is just kind of how did you get into producing, and maybe explain a little bit to the general public kind of what the role of a producer is in the production process, and maybe also the difference between producer and executive producer, co-producer, et cetera.
That's like eight questions, dude.
Yep. Well, let's get going.
All right. Well, how much time do you have? I got into producing, what's on my screen? I got into producing kind of the long way around, or into animation in general, kind of the long way around. I started off as a stand-up comic. Got a little tired of that, wandered into, well, actually decided I wanted to write instead. So I took a job that would free me up to write. I took a job as a messenger in Los Angeles. At the end of 3 years of being a messenger in Los Angeles, what I had to show for it was 3 years as a messenger in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So I thought, if I'm going to have a crappy day job, maybe it should be somewhere that could perhaps lead to something else. And that turned out to be the mailroom at an animation studio called Deke Entertainment, which lived up to their name by being Deke. They're most known for Inspector Gadget in this day and age, but they were pretty what's the word I want? They were something of a powerhouse. I mean, they had a very high number of shows on the air at any given time. It was an entirely different market then. You had your Saturday mornings, you had your afternoon syndication, all that stuff. And Deke was a provider of a lot of content. Anyway, after a few years in production there, I drifted over to Graz Entertainment, where I was working on the animated X-Men series with a guy named Larry Houston, who had also, among other things, come from Deke, so we knew each other. And in the course of that, Larry was fighting some battles with the story. And I wound up doing not really a producer's job, but, you know, evaluating where he did not need to see things because they were wrong.
Okay.
And, you know, so to some extent, a producer's sensibility guiding, you know, the management of the production. So in the course of that, Savant Entertainment was the producer and distributor. Graz was the production house.
Yep.
And Savant got the BattleTech deal. They went first to Graz. And Graz put together a budget and a schedule, whatever. Savant didn't particularly care for the budget and the schedule. They decided they would do it themselves in-house, and they were looking for a producer. So Larry Houston, who was the producer-director on X-Men, said to me one morning, "Hey, do you want to be a producer?" And I said, "Yeah." And we had a few interviews, and Saban hired me on as a producer on BattleTech, which was, you know, kind of interesting to work on this heavy-duty action-adventure show coming from essentially a comedy background. So that's how I got into it. This was Savant's first, you know, fully in-house production, and I was the guy who got to have to do it. No pressure. So the roles of, we're talking about what you might call the above-the-line roles. And believe me, I'll flood you with as much animation minutia as you want to absorb here.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, you've got... these days, you have a producer and a director and an executive producer and all that fun stuff.
Right.
At the time, the early 90s, the terms producer and director were somewhat interchangeable. And in fact, most of the time, what we would think of as a director was a producer. Disney made the distinction because Disney always makes distinctions. But, you know, there was at places like Deke and Saban and a few other of the smaller studios, producer was the title that you wanted. In fact, on a subsequent show, I gave up director as a courtesy to somebody else, which I kind of wish I'd go up to now. So when we're talking about producing BattleTech, we're essentially talking about directing BattleTech. In live action, the producer is usually the money guy, the guy who makes the deal, the guy who sets the thing up, etc. Director has creative control. in this instance, producer was, you know, creatively in charge of the production. They didn't let me see the budget. Executive producer, these are pretty much anybody who gets to boss the producer around. They may choose not to exercise that, but they have the option. And on Battletech, we had, what, 4 or 5 executive producers? You've probably got access to that more than I do. I think I met 3 of them. Okay. A couple of them were the executives at Savant who were in charge of the department. A couple of them were from the toy company. There was a Disney on there. I'm not sure what his role was. Some of them were the rights holders at FAFSA, that kind of thing. So those were the people who, you know, were the executive producers. I dealt directly, primarily, with Sam Lewis from FAFSA and Karen Brown from Tyco as the executive producers.
Excellent. And, you know, it's always a challenge adapting an existing universe to another medium, you know, and challenges with faithfulness. But for the most part, Battletech, you know, the animated series, there's a lot of kind of in-universe adherence and faithfulness there. I'm curious how you guys approached that, you know, who it was that was writing and how was FAST involved in that process?
Fair enough. Well, the writers were Robert Skier and Marty Eisenberg, their team. They kind of switched off. One would write and the other would story editor, and you'll see that reflected in the credits. Mm-hmm. And it was largely on them to maintain that faithfulness. I would say, you know, the minutia is what they worked into the scripts, but they were also obviously, you know, FAFSA was going to be heavily involved because the reality is, this is a massive universe. This is, you know, beyond a universe. This is a mythology, even as we come into, you know, whatever, 1994. And, you know, there was a lot to keep track of. And FAFSA was going to have to guide us through that, no matter how we structured the production, no matter how, you know, what stories we chose to tell, what elements we chose to emphasize. So they were right on top of that. For my part, you know, I was... A lot of my job was keeping an eye out for people who were going to throw monkey wrenches at that.
Okay.
People who were going to give us notes that didn't get, you know, that there was a universe behind this, that there was even, you know, 10 years or so in, there was a tradition behind it.
Right.
So that was, you know, that was where I was sitting in all of this. It's, you know, director, producer, yes, but almost an Uber editor when you get right down to it.
Just, right.
You know, essentially, keeping the balls in the air. One of the first conversations I had with FAFSA, Sam Lewis specifically, he goes, "You're the guy with the vision." I said, "No, you're the guy with the vision. I'm the guy who's going to make sure it survives going through the pipeline."
Yeah.
And that was what I did.
Excellent. And who's responsible for kind of deciding where and what time within that mythology it was set and kind of developing the core elements of the story?
I'm going to assume that would have predated my involvement, but I'm going to assume that, you know, that they worked it out with the story editors coming in. So they had a clear arc in mind from the outset. And obviously that's something that would have to have been worked out with Sam and FAFSA.
Gotcha. And is that something they would have kind of shopped around to the studios and Savant would have been kind of the winning bidder, you know, as it were? Was trying to understand.
Yeah, something like that. Well, in this case, the step one is, for better or worse, a toy deal.
Toy.
That was the so I don't know. Well, we'll come back. I'm ready for that one too.
Excellent.
Kind of. Generally speaking, and I'm kind of on the periphery of these things, but, you know, it probably started with a toy deal and they went looking for a studio to produce the cartoon as part of that.
Gotcha.
So, and whether we like it or not, that's not unusual. And if it's either, and people, you know, people who are animation purists kind of complain about that process, but the reality was there was a much more robust tier of creative jobs available under that process than there may be now, in spite of the explosion of animation going on out there. One property that shall remain nameless in this discussion that I worked, I did not work on, but I was a geek at the time, was a miniseries done to be sold with a toy. The toy company would commit to a full-on series if the network would. The network would commit to a full-on series if the toy company would, and therefore nothing happened. Yeah. Nobody wanted to be first. Everybody wanted to be second. So it's you know, and that was not unusual.
Right.
It's probably less you know, less overt now, but absolutely, if something goes on the air, one of the things that's going to drive its continued success is whether or not it has a, you know, merchandise tie-ins that are doing well.
Definitely, and certainly my insight into that kind of reality and universe was enhanced, you know, with the Netflix series that came out, I think, last year, you know, with the Toys That Made Us. But, you know, they also talked about comic books. You know, and there were comic books that came out around this time, you know, kind of tied into cartoon. You know, were you involved with that? You know, how did that evolve and any kind of coordination there?
I was not involved with any of that. No. You know, that's one of those things. When we come into an animation studio, or when we're talking about an animation studio, especially in this context where it was, for lack of a better term, a studio for hire, you're not going to see, I mean, the animation is what they're going to be involved in. So the peripheral merchandise, if they're not essentially the rights holder, which in this case Saban is not, then, you know, whoever the rights holder is going to be the one driving those deals for comic book tie-ins, fruit snacks, whatever. Which, by the way, my professional goal, unrealized as yet, is to work on a show that becomes Fruit Snacks. And I'm
we all got
frustrated right now.
Yeah.
We do. I was on Kim Possible. I thought, surely there will be fruit snacks for Kim Possible. No, vegetable snacks. So I'm bitter. There's no other way to put it. Yeah. So anyway. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of some of this conversations with the aforementioned Karen Brown, who did have insights into merchandising. A lot of it is even an unsuccessful show, you know, gets a merchandising deal and a licensing deal, they make money off of that. If the toys don't sell, then that deal isn't going to get renewed, all that kind of thing. So, but you know, there's all these ancillary streams which either feed off the show, depending on how you want to look at it, or the show is part of it. So I mean, it's about bluntly milking the property for anything you can.
Oh, definitely. And you know, so as producer, you're essentially a director, you know, so what do you remember some of the episodes that you were directly involved in, and kind of maybe a little bit of stories behind, you know, making those and crafting them?
Well, I was directly involved in all of them.
Okay.
Which ones did you like?
I liked episode 11, I believe is the number, the one that you know, where the Draconis background, you know, and all the kind of back history.
Okay. That may be, some of those later episodes are really, really well done. And I should warn everybody at the outset that my recollection of numbers may not match the way they were aired, because the original commitment was for 13 episodes. And as you know, there was a tip show. So I think of that as 5A, but everybody else may think of that as episode 4, 6 or something. Yeah, and the later shows were done by some good studios. So that was the other fun thing. The animation is not done in the U.S. You probably know that. Almost anything you look at was farmed out to a subcontractor. And there's subcontractors in pretty much every time zone I'm working on a production now, where we're trying to find somebody in Canada. I'm trying to talk them into looking in Korea. In the case of BattleTech, I'll free associate, and you can stop me at any time. In the case of BattleTech, the animation was done by a studio called PASSI, which was an acronym for Philippine Animation Studio. They had done, I don't know how much of a crossover there is here, they had done the first Lady Deathstrike episodes of the X-Men animated series. That was a two-parter.
Okay. Yeah.
And just to go into some other peripheral anecdotes, all their scenes had to be redone because they made Lady Deathstrike's cleavage much too, interesting. what's funny was they went ahead and mastered the show for international distribution with, you know, that cleavage. That was fine, but they had to redo all those scenes for the U.S. Anyway, they did excellent work, and they were contracted to do the series, and they animated the first two episodes, which looked pretty good. A lot of people said it looked like X-Men, so that was nice. And that was actually one of the fun things when I went in to first meet about the project. They showed me this amazing CG animation. They had hired people from Star Trek Next Generation and from Babylon 5.
Okay.
And it's feature quality. I mean, it was you know, dazzling. And I just had to turn to them and go, you know, we're animating this in the Philippines, right? And that set off a bit of a chain. because, you know, they had to, well, let's just say dumb it down. It's a little imprecise, but, you know, they had to scale back the ambition of that footage.
Right.
And I don't know if you recall, 1994, that was the year that for some reason, back in 94, that was the year that for some reason, pretty much every show felt they had to put some CG into their series.
Okay.
If they couldn't do a full budget like reboot, then, you know, they do 2 or 3 minutes of CG animation, whether it made sense or not. I'm looking at you, Iron Man. And ours was no different. There was going to be 2 or 3 minutes of CG. So anyway, there was a certain amount of back and forth as to what the CG should look like, before we hit on the look of the show. And if people are griping about, you know, how primitive the CG looks, part of that is time, but part of that is it had to, you know, fit in somehow with the animation that we were going to be seeing in the non-CG portion.
Right.
And that sheet was enhanced imaging, which we'll more about that momentarily. But what I liked about the look we came up with is, and I don't know that I've seen anybody pick up on this, maybe I just don't get out enough. If you think about it, what we are seeing in those scenes is what virtual reality might look like to a cartoon character. And that was the thing, I think, that set us apart from everybody else doing 3 minutes of animation as a gimmick. And we also, as you know, we made it a plot point for the entire arc of our heroes getting a hold of whatever the technology was that was giving the bad guys that advantage in battle. It was kind of fun with the CG animators as well, because for the 2D animators, you want them to follow exactly what you sent them in the way of reference material.
Yeah.
But for the CG animators, you know, I deferred to them as to what was possible, what was sensible, what would look good. And I just said, look, here's the storyboard. You know, just make it look cool. If you're not exactly following it, you know, that's fine, because it's going up a level. So that turned into some discussions where I would, you know, describe certain shots or certain things. And because what we presented to this as our sort of story rationale was this was the super tactical battle feed that gave, you know, the clans the advantage. And obviously it wasn't any kind of tactical battle feed at all. But that led to, you know, the animation director at FAFSA going, well, there's no real tactical advantage to a shot like this. I said, look, this is just a gimmick. Yeah. This is just our rationale. We just want it to look cool. That's the advantage. It looks cool. So that was some of the fun. We had a little, took us a little while to sort of get them on board as to what level of fluidity the animation was capable of to match the 2D, and, you know, to some extent, wherever we could, we just let the CG drive the train. Anyway, so we had a deal with this very good animation studio, not privy to the financials. It apparently was a co-production deal, which means, well, Ben, when I say we, I mean the studio I was working for. Let me specify now, everything I'm saying is coming purely from my perspective. But apparently they had a co-production deal, which meant they weren't getting paid. They had a piece of the action, whatever the action turned out to be. So because of their workload, for whatever reason, they wound up subcontracting to a few other studios. And, you know, some of those studios were good and some of them less so. So my one of my storyboard artists put it best. He said, what's going on with your show? 1 week it looks like X-Men, and the next week it looks like it was drawn by 5-year-olds. Yeah. And that's where things got subcontracted. Because at least one of those subcontractors, I think, farmed it out to 3 or 4 other studios. So that was an interesting challenge as we went through this series. Yeah. So as we get into the later episodes, they got some stronger studios. There was one in particular that was animated by Coco, who was doing Batman, the animated series at the time. That was probably the best looking show. I don't know if it was the best story. And then as we got into, for the big finale, I think Passy took it on again, and we got a nice looking show out of that too. The other fun thing was, as we were producing the show, because of the demands of a production schedule, and one of the questions I'm always asked about animation is, how long does it take to make a show? And my answer is 9 months, same as a baby. So, but the CG stuff, because it was 2 or 3 minutes, was, you know, a month. maybe a little more. So they were running well ahead of the 2D animation. So I had, you know, I had six shows worth of CG before I had two episodes worth of traditional animation. So that was part of the fun as well. So the promos were largely built out of the CG. The main titles were largely built out of the CG. Fun stuff like that.
And so, you know, is the voice acting done in the U.S. and then kind of, you know, tied in with what they're doing in the Philippines? And so it sounds like there might be three different studios producing. If that sounds right.
Not really. It's the traditional pipeline. Again, I'll give you as much minutiae as you want. You've got pre-production, production, and post-production. Okay. Most studios, Saban, Deke, Disney, Nickelodeon, where I am now, pre-production done here, post-production done out of the country, production rather. The actual animation is done out of the country, and then post-production handled by the studio that's producing the show. So it's really just those two entities. Saban had their own recording setup, so you know they handled that. The recording was done in the U.S. Other productions recorded in Canada because you can get because it's cheaper. But what happens is the dialogue is recorded. It's then transferred. Well, this is the old days. It's then transferred to something called exposure sheets, which are 11 by 17 sheets with a bunch of lines on them. Every 16 lines constitutes a foot of film, and every frame of the show is accounted for in those exposure sheets, including mouth movements. So every character gets a mouth chart, which is usually five or six positions to simulate lip sync. When I'm looking to see if sync is maybe off, I look for the F mouths and the O mouths. I don't think they're labeled that way, but those are the sounds they go with. And if you want to have fun, you can do that too. So all that is sent overseas with the track, and the animators, like I said, they follow slavishly what's laid out in the exposure sheets.
Gotcha.
There's a fun anecdote about that too. So the other pre-production materials, there's model design, which is, you know, three or four views of the characters, so they know what they look like from multiple dimensions. You got storyboards. What I tell people, the short version is model designs is all the nouns in the script, and the storyboards are all the verbs, but they lay out the action, the camera angles, you know, all that stuff. The timing, well, the timing, not so much in the board stage, but you know, there is a account for that. These days, everything gets an animatic, which is basically just filming a storyboard or scanning it and assembling it with the dialogue track and putting in, you know, whatever pacing you want.
Right.
So exposure sheets are largely off the table now because of that. But in the days of the 90s, they were pretty much what drove that part of the process.
Gotcha.
And so all that material goes to the track, and all that material goes to the animators. I don't know if they listen to the track. I think they look at the exposure sheets, since a lot of the animators don't speak English. Sometimes even when they do speak English, you find a language barrier. So that's the steps there. Those are the basics. And then, you know, comes back, we cut the show, we send it off to sound effects editors, dialogue editors, to make sure the dialogue is clean, lines up, and if there's additional dialogue needed, we ADR that. And of course, the music team.
And we talked about my favorite episode. Did you have a favorite episode that you worked on? One that stands out?
The ones that stand out would be because they weren't favorites. the one that, like I said, the one that Coco did was probably the best looking show. Mm-hmm. The last episode, I think, came out really well. It's a shame we couldn't build off of it. So those are the favorites. The memorable ones were like the two-parters because what's fun was we got that show 7 and 8, I think it was. We had to build. We didn't. The great thing was because of the way the show was subcontracted, and because we had a sequential story arc, we didn't necessarily get the shows in the order that they were supposed to come.
Okay.
So I don't know how well you remember that time, or if you remember even paying that much attention to the continuity in this thing. We were able to get the first three shows done. Wasn't easy. Took some scrambling. The fourth show was, in fact, a two-parter with the third show. It simply was not going to get to us in time. So we went to the fifth show, and nobody seemed to notice. That was the episode where Zero was captured by the clans in show three, and you know, he started to turn in show four, and I think by show five he was totally in there. So gotcha. We never quite it's secondary, and we had everything. That was the other fun thing. Sometimes the show would go on the air before it was really done.
Well, I remember,
so that was fun. And then shows.
I remember watching it, and I did not watch it in order, nor could I find most of the episodes. The first time I watched beginning to end was when we remastered the series, you know, around this time last year. And some of the episodes I had never even seen. I saw, you know, episode 1, 2, 3 many, many, many times, and then all of a sudden it would skip to another one. But it makes a little more sense.
Yeah, that was why. So the other fun pairing was, I think it was show 7 and 8 where Kristen is captured by the by Steiner. Mm-hmm. I barely remember those names, I got to tell you.
You did well. That's good.
Anyway, she's captured, okay, in show 8 she starts to turn. And the thing was, we were going to go ahead and air show 8. We didn't have show 7. So I figured, okay, we'll build a recap. This is why it's memorable. So I had to build a recap, as you recall, there was a recap in every episode, of a show that did not exist. And I'm pretty proud of that, because a combination of the animation for, you know, the next 6 episodes already being in hand, and force-feeding dialogue over footage from show 6, let us build something that looked like there was an actual episode we were pulling from. So there you are. There's the sausage being made, as Bismarck said.
Definitely. Well, I know there's.
So that was good fun.
I know there's
the other one was
5A. Awesome. Yeah, which we haven't remastered the copy. The only copy out there is just too bad for us to try to tackle.
I don't have a better one. I can guarantee.
Yeah.
Whatever tapes I have, I've been sitting in my garage for 15 years, so they're probably not any good. The other fun show was episode 6, where we had the studio that did this had shipped us everything but the action scenes. So we wound up, I had an excellent editor, just stealing footage and cheating. We had the CG, but the 2D action scenes, we just didn't have. They just didn't give us anything but dialogue. And we wound up sort of like building fake explosions and stealing, you know, shots and footage from other shows. And, you know, it was good enough to apparently fool a lot of the audience. If you didn't know, you probably wouldn't. That's my lodestar when I'm, you know, in the driver's seat for any of this.
Yeah.
And when we did get the action footage from the studio, it was not as good as what we had cobbled together in the editing. I think we wound up keeping most of it. So episode 5A, as we so quaintly refer to it, was an interesting thing. So we got, like I say, we had shows 1, 3, and 5. It took a lot of scrambling to get them on the air. I was working till 3 a.m, many nights a week. All of this was pre-digital, so that made for some fun. It's why they have really good cappuccinos at post houses. So, you know, finally it looks like maybe I'm going to get a weekend out of this production. So my wife had come to the office to, you know, have lunch, hang out for a little while, and as we're waiting for word of whatever the next show was to come in, and we had gotten, this is a Friday morning, we get confirmation that it's just not going to come. We're not going to see it for 2 more weeks, whatever. So, you know, we're going to miss an air date, all of that. So I'm walking my wife to the elevator. The VP of production is coming the other way. I stop him in the halls. I say, look, you know, I just got the facts. We had faxes in those days.
Yeah.
We had faxes in those days, and we had to walk 2 miles through the snow to get them uphill, both ways.
And pages.
So I say to him, and so I said, look, you know, we just got the facts. It's just the show is not coming in for 2 more weeks. That's just, you know, there's nothing we can do. And this goes, well, I guess we're in reruns then. And my wife, who was a former development executive, in fact, had my office in that building when she was working for a TV movie producer who had a deal with Saban, in her glib fashion says, well, why don't you just take episode 1 and redub it since it didn't make any sense anyway? And you hear the expression, a light bulb went on over somebody's head. I swear to God, I saw that happen with our VP of production, who just kind of goes, let me make some calls. And he walks off, and I said to my wife, that's my weekend. don't make jokes like that in front of a VP. And so it came back as, well, let's do a clip show. You know, it's true. Some of the elements of the story maybe could be clearer. So we'll explain all that. And so Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, we convened at Savan. And I think Tycho paid for the donuts, but we kind of hammered out a rough framework for the editor, the story editors, Bob and Marty, and Karen Brown, who was the executive producer from Tycho, and we just all kind of hammered out a story the framework, I guess I should say, that would make sense and lend itself to the stronger moments from the show. Right. And they went off and wrote a script in a weekend, and we recorded it on a Tuesday night, and I think we built the thing on a Thursday and delivered it, and that was the fabulous episode 5A, No Guts. No Galaxy.
And we got it's to work a good one. It's good voiceover. I just wish we could get the visuals.
Let me ask.
Yep.
Oh, go ahead.
So I was going to say, I thought I would try to recut it from the other episodes that we had published. And I'm just, you know, I have no editing background. I just cut together these podcasts. And so I got about 2-3 hours in of cutting, you know, 1-2 second clips together. And I was like, this is beyond my volunteer time, you know, abilities to do this. This would be like a 2-month professional project for me to try to.
You go. You see, everybody think we make it look easy.
Yeah.
So how do you go about remastering something where you don't have access to the source material?
Well, so it's a great question. There were VHS copies, you know, people record on their VHS tapes back in the 90s. And somewhere along the line, people had converted those VHS copies into digitals, and those were floating around various places on the internet. And there were copies of those on YouTube already. And so there's the person who helped produce this with me, Emil, who lives in Denmark. He does a lot of upscaling for old BattleTech art, just to kind of give high quality flyers for people. And he had announced on his Twitter that he was going to do that for the cartoon. And I reached out to him because I didn't know he had a YouTube channel. I was like, hey, this is great. I would be happy to host this on Renegade HPG. And so we started working together. And then through the process, we had all the episodes, but some of them were just much rougher than others. And so I embarked on a project to basically try to track down better copies of the ones that weren't good.
I see.
And so that took a couple months, and I was reaching out, you know, and even after we published the first one, somebody reached out to me who had better copies than anything we had. So I actually, you know, a week into episode one on, I upscaled a new one, deleted the old file and re-uploaded it. And then the rest we kind of went, and he didn't have all of them. And so some of the episodes are a little rougher than others, but he had used AI upscale technology to take those VHS copies and make them a lot nicer. And then I would take the audio and try to kind of clean up the audio a little bit.
Gotcha.
And tie it in. And then most of the episode, because they were VHS copies, they were kind of, someone would cut off the beginning or cut off the end. And so I wanted to try to make it as close to what you would see on the television as possible, with the intro credits and all the outro credits, all the way up to the Saban logo playing. Gotcha. And so, you know, I kind of spliced all the videos together, and sometimes took intros and outros from other episodes, put them together. And so now it's, you know what, best we could get to intro sequence to Saban's logo on all the episodes, as high quality as we could get. I think.
Well, if you need an editing tip, that at periodic points in the production, we thought maybe a really good way, if we were running short or anything, would be to have Adam go, I wonder what my friends the Power Rangers are doing, and a little bit of that, just add it out. So, you know, that's no charge for that. If it helps you, great, fantastic.
There you go.
But yeah. So you know, and you know, Power Rangers. Who even remembers that?
Yeah. So that was our process. And I guess that leads me into one of the questions I had, was like, what's any insight into why this never made it into any kind of VHS, or, you know, which may lead into kind of what was the fate of the series? You know, what stopped it?
I think that probably ties into that overall comment about just, you know, ancillary merchandise and success of the property per se. Gotcha. And fun things like that. I mean, the ratings were not good on this show. And therefore, you know, for the people who look at spreadsheets, that becomes not a lot of interest in the property even though clearly we're having this conversation because there is interest in this property.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the other thing that comes down to it. There's the fervency of the audience is a wonderful thing. And but unfortunately, if it's not matched by numbers, it remains simply that, the fervency of the audience. So as this has been, obviously, this was, you know, a property with what's the word I want? I don't even want to call it a fan base because that doesn't do justice. But, you know, it had that kind of dedication behind it, but it didn't translate into ratings. It probably didn't help that it was, I don't know how it aired across the rest of the country. In Los Angeles, it was shown at 11:30 on a Sunday morning, which is a really good time to not watch things.
Right.
So a lot of people took advantage of that and didn't watch it. We would get the ratings, and what was pretty cool was we were number one among 16 to 24 year olds. And you have to, if you don't know this, the key demographic for a show like this is 6 to 11. So,
well, the 24 year olds.
Hey, yeah, number one. Oh, it's 16 to 24. But that's cool.
Yeah.
But it doesn't help us.
Right. Those are not the toys that you were, the toy market that you were.
And the toys,
for.
I don't think, did very well either. Well, here's you know, a little more behind the scenes stuff. So, one of the early meetings, we're just discussing just everything about the project. And so I'm in a room with a couple of toy company execs, and they explained to me, and it made perfect sense when they did, that a really good time to launch a new toy line is,
I think it's October, right?
December 26th.
Really?
Because all the kids who had broken Power Ranger toys and are exchanging them for good Power Ranger toys, but, oh, they're out of Power Ranger toys, buy BattleTech instead.
Fair.
And I think we can kind of guess how that turned out by everything we said on this podcast.
Right.
And to be perfectly honest, the toys were only so-so.
Yeah,
I saved the boxes because they're cooler
than the toys. Yeah.
Oh, the X-Man is behind there somewhere, but the box is cooler. Yeah. My art director took the Thor. I said, "Hey, you can have the Thor. I want the box."
I want the box. Well, the commercials are great.
CG team.
The commercials are great. Hit them in the blast panel. I mean, I have the same reaction when people hit me in the blast panel, you know, as those mechs. So
I get hit in the blast panel on a regular basis. It's on my resume under both special skills and interests.
There you go. And so with these, I guess, kind of tying into Saban and the VHS, you know, even unsuccessful things tend to make it through. You know, any insights into why, you know, this never made it onto videotape? Because, you know, certainly that's what pushed us into doing the remasters, is there simply, you know, no.
It was, you know, it was just merchandising in general. Again, unfortunately, I'm surprised that people remember the show at all. My son found the history of animated BattleTech on YouTube, which is where you tracked me down.
Yep.
And brought that to my attention. So I was kind of like, well, that was, I didn't look at that for a year. My first comment was, I produced this show, and I'm surprised anybody remembers it. Apparently, people remember it, so that's good.
Well, BattleTech people are great.
No fruit snacks.
Yeah, no fruit snacks.
Where are the fruit snacks, BattleTech people? Is this so much to ask? It's fruit. It's a snack. Why is this so difficult?
That'll be in the next Kickstarter that they do.
I'm on a show now that I'm like looking at it going, okay, it's a 2-year commitment. I don't see fruit snacks coming out of this one either. So.
Oh, man.
I thought maybe the Muppet Babies might be fruit snacks. No.
That could have been a good one. I could have seen that one.
I think they could have done. Now, I did a show called Extreme Dinosaurs, which is not really something to write home about either. I saw the pajamas in the Target. I thought, surely the fruit snacks are far on their way. No fruit snacks.
So are you kind of aware of how the cartoon ties into the official BattleTech universe? Because, you know, I think it's probably one of the greatest kind of creative moves that I know of kind of in.
I saw a passing reference that it has been incorporated as inner sphere propaganda.
Yep.
Which is probably probably works better on that basis than it does as a merchandising strategy for a toy line.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, it's Steiner propaganda, you know, during the Klan invasion. It was absolutely
Well, you know
brilliant.
what? In a sense, it's not so different from what we did to integrate the CG in the first place. It's sort of like,
Exactly.
okay, when life hands you a really good lemon, make really good lemonade. So
Definitely.
that's, yeah, I found out about that just recently. My exposure to the universe is largely limited to this show.
Definitely. It's inspired a lot of memes. I mean, people are all about their memes these days, but there's been some good stuff. You know, it's still inspiring. My favorite feedback that I get is, you know, parents are finally able to show their kids, you know, what they were watching when they were growing up for their BattleTech love. But
one of the joys of this business is running into people who grew up watching what I worked on.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
And when I say joys, I mean it's kind of appalling, really. But okay. I guess it was inevitable.
We can't always hit home runs.
Yeah. Running into people who go, oh, I love that show when I was a kid that I worked on. And the other fun thing is I'm now working with the children of people I worked with when I started out. So that's an interesting development in the course of this business.
Yeah, well, when I coach for
a living. So did you watch it?
Sorry. I say I coach for a living. And, you know, seeing athletes with birthdays, you know, that are, you know, 2006, 2007, I'm just like, oh, that's rough.
I'm still wrapping my head around the fact that Kim Possible, which was, you know, which I spent like 4 or 5 years on, was 20 years ago. It's like,
yeah.
Really? It should be like 5 or so now.
Definitely.
So there you are. Stupid Earth going around the sun and making time pass.
Definitely. Well, there's some good fan art. I'll show you real quick. You can kind of enjoy some of this stuff with me if you
Yeah. I know what I'm Googling after this.
Let's see. We were talking about Kristen. Let's see. Here's a good fan art of Kristen. This is by Jason Troxell, who I'm actually, you know, would like to get on the podcast. We're talking to him about trying to do something maybe in January. But yeah, he's got some great art.
That's quite cool.
Hey, Kristen, let's see. What else has he got? Got Nikolai.
We did actually try to incorporate some of the art from the books, from the source books, into the shows. Most of that's in the main title. If anybody's interested, there are specific shots that jumped out at me that we worked in. I don't know if we did justice to them, but we were inspired by them.
Definitely.
Well, that's very cool.
And we got some memes.
That's funny.
This is a good one. Yeah, Jason has some good comics. Good art here. This one ties in more if you know the tabletop game.
Well, I can sort of pick it up as I go along.
But he's got some good work. And there's the Nikolai Malthus has been memed as much as you can meme something. Is You Dare to Refuse My Bachal is kind of a big meme in the BattleTech community. There's lots of stuff there about that one.
I had to keep explaining to our editor what a bachal is as we were cutting those shows. It was one of our running gags was, you know, he'd ask me what was going on, and I'd tell him it was something from the books and go, well, how do we know that? And I said, well, it'll be in the study guide.
Kids,
because we damn near needed one.
You know, the target audience doesn't pay attention. Maybe those 24-year-olds are going to be like, wait, what are they talking about?
there are a few people who pick up on the minutia. They're the folks who go through frame by frame for everything now, which is much harder in that time. And it's like, hey, they totally reuse this background from show 3. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there's a lot of things that
draw
I saw.
Something if it already exists.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things I saw while editing that I never would have picked up, you know, watching. It's like there'll be shots where the cockpit will change. You'll go from wearing a helmet to not wearing a helmet. You know, there was one where there were two elementals fighting in a jump ship. And the color of the elementals kept switching, you know, who was in what color elemental. But there's lots of little relics in there.
We did that to see who was watching. There are no mistakes, only tests.
Of course not. Of course not.
One of my son's friends was a major animation and anime nerd, and he would ask me about whatever mistake he'd seen in a show, you know, that whatever. It's not even what I'd worked on. I'd just say, you know, you see the show after we're done fixing 110 mistakes.
Yeah.
You get the 5 that we didn't have time to get back, and we kind of figured, nobody will notice.
Yeah.
And by and large, you know, they don't. Even sometimes on like classic films, I'm surprised at what I see now, having spent 30 years, you know, in production, that I never picked up on the other six times I watched the movie, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, coming from the official side, I'm curious, you know, this is always a question in the community and with fan-created content, you know, if there's, and we have some great animators out there in community, you know, DC Bruins being my favorite, who we did an animatic earlier this year, which is fabulous. But I'm curious, you know, from the official side of things, any insights that you can give to people out there looking to kind of do fan creations of kind of do's and don'ts of, you know, where to get permissions, how to do it? What's the extent of what you can do without permissions?
I don't actually have any insight into that, because that would be a question for a lawyer. There's fair use provisions, obviously. If you're doing something for profit, you're going to have a problem. If you're doing something for just the sheer joy of it, there's a certain amount you can get away with. I mean, if you're doing a parody, is always something of a gray area. I hate to be glib about it, but it kind of comes down to, what are you willing to defend in court if somebody objects to it?
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, I learned that listening to an interview with one of the editors from The Onion. I couldn't really answer that. If you're making money off of it, somebody's going to be upset. If you're putting something out there as a, I don't know, a test for your skills, way of showcasing your you know, abilities, I think that's legitimate, but certainly maybe the word is defensible. And the other thing too is, you know, is it something that anybody's really going to take notice of?
Yeah.
I hate to put it in those terms. I think of the story I read, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, where Disney basically took a nursery school to court for having a picture of Mickey Mouse painted on their wall, and you know, made them take it down. And it's like, well, okay, some people will go after a nursery school, some people will go after, you know, a YouTube video, all that kind of stuff. So it's just yeah, this is definitely above my pay grade, as it were.
Fair. So what are you working on currently, Kurt? Yeah, where's
currently I am working on a show that was just announced, and I honestly can't say anything more than the title, called Rock, Paper, Scissors.
Okay.
Which is a return to 2D. My previous gig was Muppet Babies, and another show also just announced, which is going to be on Netflix, called Action Pack, which are both preschool and CG. And you know, they have their challenges. Every demographic, every medium has its unique challenges. So this is going back to 2D, going back to the 6 to 11 demographic, maybe even the upper end. Like I say, I can't tell you much more than the title, but it's pretty darn funny. And I'm very jaded about such things. I tend to register at something as being funny rather than laugh at it, and this has me laughing at it. So
awesome.
I'm enjoying rock, paper, myself scissors, so far.
Huh? Is that rock?
It's paper, called scissors? Rock, paper, scissors.
Okay. Where's it going to air?
I think it's going to be Paramount Plus. I just got there, so I don't know exactly how they work. Apparently they structure everything, so it can be broadcast on Nickelodeon as well. So, but beyond that, I don't really know. Those are in somebody else's hands. I just make the show, or help make the show in this case.
Sounds good. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, Kurt. You know, take us a little bit, you know, this trip down memory lane, kind of give a little history behind the cartoon, which I know a lot of people have been enjoying on the channel now. So
every frame is soaked in blood, damn it.
And appreciate, you know, the time you put in and the effort you put in back in the 90s. You know, kind of
it's
a delay.
Definitely nice delay to know that somebody watched it eventually.
Definitely. Well, my little girl enjoyed it while I was remastering. She's like, Daddy, can we watch Battletech today? I was like, of course.
There you go. My son was like 8 at the time, and he would call retakes on it. After it, as it was airing. So I'm kind of going, did you know that shot there was reused? Yes, Alex, I'm the one who said reuse it. So, good fun. Good fun there.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Kurt. And thanks to
everyone. My pleasure.
Thanks
for watching, darn it.
Definitely. All right. Take care, everyone.
destroyed. Primary objective successful. Proceed to dust off zone for extraction. Sensors indicate friendly dropship has entered atmosphere. ETA dropship, 1 minute. Shutdown sequence initiated.